integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation. Welcome back to Military Justice. Thanks for joining us again. We're fortunate to be joined by Todd South, a reporter for the Marine Corps Times and Military Times. He reports on ground combat issues, former reporter on criminal courts issues, and also former active duty Marine. Todd and I are going to be discussing a death. I'm hesitant to call it a murder. We obviously, there's the presumption of innocence for all the parties involved, but a death of a Green Beret, and it seems to be at the hands of two or possibly three Navy SEALs. And when I say at the hands of, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're guilty of any sort of crime, but it does seem that, at least from their stories, that they had suggested that his asphyxiation occurred during some training. This happened in Mali, so literally in Timbuktu. So I think this is important, as Todd and I discuss, both from the military justice aspect, the difficulty, I'll try to explain the difficulty of trying to convict a Navy SEAL, if in fact the Navy SEAL did this, and then also I think what's important for the general public to know where our forces are around the world. So after the short clip you'll hear, you'll get into the interview I conducted with Todd South. Again, thank you as always for being here. Thank you for supporting our sponsors, and I hope you enjoy this.
It turns out, our reporting has revealed, is that two Navy SEALs involved in an intelligence activity in Mali, in West Africa, a place where not a lot of Americans know we even have a substantial military or intelligence presence, were involved with a fund that paid out informants for information of a counterterrorism nature. Staff Sergeant Melger found out about that. They were, in fact, taking money from the fund. An altercation ensued, and now we're at where we're at. These two Navy SEALs under investigation for the death of Sergeant Melger.
I mean, but these guys are on the same team, and that it could have possibly been that would have led to his death. I mean, one of the things that strikes me in your reporting is that Staff Sergeant Melger, according to your report, told his wife that he was having trouble or concerns about some of the guys on his team. Did she know who he was talking about at the time?
It's not my understanding that she knew specifically. It's my understanding that Sergeant Melger said he would explain more when he got home, and now he'll never have an opportunity to do that.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, your reporting also is that the SEALs told their superiors that Melger was drunk when all this happened. Is there anything to back that up at this point?
In fact, there's information to contradict that information, that when eventually investigators looked in on that, they found that there was no trace of alcohol or drugs in Sergeant Melger's system, and that's a key piece of information that led to this investigation.
Todd, thanks for being on the program today. For the listeners that haven't heard you previously on here, can you give us a little thumbnail on your background?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a prior service Marine vet, enlisted, served back in the invasion of Iraq, got out, became a journalist. Now, as of the past year or so, I've been writing for Army and Marine Corps Times. My focus is on ground combat. That usually involves all your ground combat elements and often gets into some of the special operations immigration force things, but also do a lot of military justice stuff when time permits, because I have a courts reporting background for my days as a civilian reporter.
And today we are here to talk about the death of Army Staff Sergeant Logan J. Melgar. Tell me about how you came across this story.
Well, I'll be the first to admit I did not break the story. The New York Times, the heck of a team of good reporters, broke this story. I believe it was, I think it was September or October, but the actual incident took place in early June. So it stayed quiet for a very long time. And I think really only got revealed because they probably had some real good sources who let them know this is going on. Nothing really has been said publicly from the Army or the Navy who are investigating or any of the branches, really.
Okay, so we're talking, the death was in early June of 2017. So was the death ever reported by DOD?
And that kind of tripped me up. And if I'm incorrect here, I probably will be corrected by somebody who's following the details closely. I could not find, so what the DOD does, Department of Defense, they put out death and casualty notification stuff after they've alerted the family. Regularly, consistently, combat, non-combat. I mean, somebody is serving in Kuwait, has a heart attack, and dies on duty. You find out about it within a few days. I've never seen or found any notification of his death since June. I've searched back the archives to those dates and subsequently not found it. The fact that this guy even died or anything potentially happened wasn't publicly revealed until the first reporting began on this, I believe, in October or September.
Yeah, that is a little bit odd because, like you're saying, DOD just puts out, usually within about 24 to 72 hours, puts out the report of any deaths anywhere. And obviously DOD wants some time to contact immediate family members before they just publish it. But those statistics are published very regularly.
Oh, yeah, they're consistent. Obviously, the height of the wars, I mean, you can set up an actual, email to your inbox. And,
right.
My coverage was mostly of Guard and Reserve units, years ago as a new and young reporter. I mean, I would get three or four of those in a week and a day if combat was pretty heavy and you got a lot of casualties. And even if things somewhat quieted down, like I said, something is a vehicle incident where someone is killed or even, like a natural causes kind of
right,
thing.
Right, right.
They don't provide a lot of detail on these initially. Sometimes they'll give a sentence or two, but they basically name, rank, unit, hometown, and that's kind of where it ends. You have to probe further and make calls and questions and requests, but you get some kind of notification. And I couldn't find anything for him. If I missed it, that's my bad, but I looked pretty hard.
No, I've done the same thing, and I can't find anything about that from June until late September, early October, I think, is when you said the New York Times, but I think the Daily Beast, you along with the Daily Beast, have also been covering this quite a bit.
Well, I think most closely, I would say, the New York Times really has led a lot of coverage on this. I'll pass off to them. And of course, a lot of this kind of followed suit with some of our sources, and of course, crediting different outlets when they break different portions of it. I believe it was The Intercept, I think, broke a pretty interesting portion of it that I'm sure we'll talk about. So it's been a kind of a collective effort on multiple different media organizations, kind of cribbing notes off of each other, because it's such a dip. I mean, you're talking about military, you're talking about overseas, you're talking about Africa, and you're talking about SOCOM. So it's like the layers upon layers upon layers. I mean, the only thing worse would probably be like CIA or something out of that.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, we're talking about special forces being in Mali. So literally this happens in close proximity to Timbuktu, the actual Timbuktu. I mean, this is as far away from normal operations as you can get.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's actually interesting. You say that, it's something I think that our folks are not plugged into this or maybe not so up to speed on your current military operations. Probably were made aware of. I mean, we've been operating in Africa for a decade plus. I mean, you can even go back to Mogadishu in 93, but I mean, subsequently to 9/11, there's been growing and building, although way escalation of forces and equipment just in the recent last 3 to 5 years, but we've had a presence in different countries there for a very long time. But the average American, especially the person not connected to the military, I think has zero interest or knowledge about that. However, this death alone, this death coupled with the death of a paratrooper and some Green Berets over Niger, pretty close time frame to this, has really, I think, piqued some interest, especially in Congress, about what are we doing in Africa, what are we using our forces and our equipment and our money for?
Right. I think that's... It's important to report on all of these deaths, but it's also important, I think, for the average member of the public to know that, okay, you, after 9/11, we have the authorization for the use of military force. And it says, you know, paraphrasing, it says Iraq, Afghanistan, and, you know, Al-Qaeda and allied forces. And that's been expanded into, like you say, over a decade of operations in North Africa. I mean, is that really what Congress authorized?
That's being, I think, hotly debated, not just in Africa, but elsewhere. But I think, you know, the fact that people know a lot about these things just generally, and the fact that these incidents have occurred amongst, you know, friendly on friendly, you know, green on green kind of thing, with the situation, also, of course, the tragic mission that the Green Berets are involved with, has really raised the spotlight to a degree on what's going on there.
Yeah, and understanding the need for these to be clandestine missions, but, you know, wouldn't give out the exact details, but, you know, does the average member of public know that we're operating throughout North Africa, and are they in favor of that? You know, do we have an endless war where we're just operating with no boundaries and Congress not really being involved that much? You know, at least after their original authorization for the use of military force.
Yeah, it's definitely a balancing act. You hit both sides on the head very quickly with that. I mean, yeah, you have clandestine things, you have national security interests, you at least you trust that you do. You have, you know, other nation states that need our help that are, I mean, people have heard of course, Al-Qaeda, you know, there in Africa. I'm sure there's ISIS elements, you know, Boko Haram. I mean, horrible things going on amongst these different nations. But yeah, there's a good question. There's horrible stuff going on all over the world. I mean, do we need to be everywhere? And that's really up for the voters, the taxpayers, and of course the representatives to try to suss out as they learn things.
Pitney Bowes is the industry leader in mailing and shipping solutions. No matter what you send or how often, Pitney Bowes has the solution that precisely fits your needs. Weigh, print, mail, and save. You and your business will save time and money when you print postage, and you won't need to wait in line at the post office anymore. You also won't need to worry about putting the correct amount of postage on your letter. On January 21st, USPS mailing and shipping costs went up, but you'll save 3 cents per letter with a Pitney Bowes solution. These discounts are not available at the post office, but you'll be able to beat the increase using Pitney Bowes. Whether you're sending a letter or package, you'll be paying less and saving money if you're using a Pitney Bowes storage solution. Plans start at just $5 per month. And for listeners of Military Justice, Pitney Bowes is offering a free trial, so you're sure to find the solution that's right for you. Visit pb.com/justice. Again, that's pb.com/justice. And learn more and get a free trial. Terms apply, and you'll need to see the site for details. But go to pb.com/justice. And we thank Pitney Bowes for sponsoring the podcast. And remember, you sponsoring our sponsors helps keep Military Justice moving along. Thank you. Okay, now that we've decided all of the national security problems for the United States, luckily we could had a little time to do that this morning. So now let's get to the actual death. So we have the Army Green Beret Staff Sergeant, and then how many SEALs were involved or alleged? I think we can safely say now that the SEALs were involved, you know, by their own admissions with his death, but there's a question whether it was accidental or purposeful.
Right, and we have to stress throughout as we discuss this, and I've stressed throughout as I write, and I think my fellow journalists do as well. These are allegations. I spent a good chunk of my career as a crime reporter. You've spent, you know, a lifetime in law, and these have not been proven guilty. In fact, no one's actually been charged yet. I mean, the folks involved have only been put on administrative leave situation and pulled back to the U.S. Just want to put that out the gate, but yeah, basically the scenario kind of winds like this. I can go somewhat chronologically and kind of talk about what was revealed as it happened. But back on, I believe it was early June. I think it was June 4th, very early in the morning, at some kind of off-base embassy housing there in the Mali capital. There was, you know, Green Beret, you know, that's our Melgar. He was living there with at least three other SEALs. Initial reports, you know, were this, there was this death. That was reported automatically to the Army Command. They sent CID down there. And come, you know, initial stories are, he's been drinking, we don't know what happened. And that's the end of the story. And then after this, these two SEALs were confronted by investigators with the fact that, you know, the soft office shows he'd been strangled. They said, oh, we were wrestling around and it was accidental. We thought he was okay. And we went back to check on him and he wasn't responding. And of course, it just goes from there, really. There's more things that were revealed down the line according to different reports.
Yeah, okay, so the first report is just call the equivalent of whatever in 911 is in Mali, but they just call the authorities and say, we don't know why our roommate is dead.
Well, they actually tried to get him some help. They tried to revive him, and they tried to get him to a local hospital.
Okay.
That's once he goes to the hospital and he obviously doesn't revive, then they have to report it. The authorities are reported. So, yeah, technically, no, the SEALs didn't report themselves. They were trying to rush to the hospital, I think, with a third roommate, I believe, and were trying to, you know, do CPR. I think at least that's what they told investigators.
So then subsequent to that, we know that when confronted by the military police, either CID or NCIS or a mix, then the story comes out that we were doing mixed martial arts training, probably Brazilian jiu-jitsu or something at the time, right, and that's why he lost consciousness.
That's the gist, which immediately, I mean, you know, I checked with some folks, you know, and through some other contacts secondhand who, you know, are familiar with that. And I'm not a trained MMA fighter. I very minimal kind of training, but the fact that you would be doing that at, you know, 4 or 5 a.m. in your private housing, I mean, you know, initially I think some people thought, oh, well, these guys were drunk or they were brawling around and something went wrong. But the story that they were actually doing quote-unquote training, just, I think, raises an eyebrow immediately. Like, who's doing MMA at 4:30 in the morning in your private residence? That just doesn't make sense.
Right, and so what are the ranks of the two SEALs accused? We don't need to go in their names, but, like, what are the ranks?
You have, I believe, a chief petty officer and a petty officer. They're both in their 30s. One, I think, is, like, 38 years old. The victim, Shatter Melgar, is 34. He came to the Army a little bit later. He didn't come, like, right out of high school. He came a couple of years later. He'd only been in the Army, I think, a few years and only had one deployment prior to this.
Yeah, that's one thing I wanted to stress is that this isn't like, no disrespect to our Marine Corps brethren, but this isn't like, you know, Marine Corps infantry guys who might be 19. By the time you get to this senior level of operator, you are, a seasoned member of the military. You know, you're at least, like you're saying, in your 30s.
Oh, yeah, not just that. I mean, with the SEAL example, for instance, they were both SEAL Team 6 members. And, I mean, folks who read all the popular novels, watch the movies, probably know or play the video game. SEAL Team 6 is, like, the best of the best. I mean, they're like the cream of the SEAL crop. You know, I mean, a lot of guys will go to, you know, Team 2 or Team 3 or wherever and do different types of missions and have a couple of deployments there. And they still, even after having done all the SEAL training and having been a live, you know, active SEAL out operating, they still got to do a huge trial, another long kind of indoctrination process and training process to get into 6. So it gets a level upon level. I mean, you get to that level, you know, yeah, you may have only been in, you know, 8 or 10 years, but you definitely have a lot of experience, a lot of training, and you're definitely not some kid right out of high school, even right out of college.
Right. These aren't teenagers doing the. Do you remember a couple of years ago when the Marines, they kept having those videos of the Marine would be wearing a flak jacket and the other one would come running down the squad bay and kick him in the chest?
I probably did some of that stuff way back in my old days. I mean, yeah, you got a bunch of knuckleheads, you know, Lance Corporals and PFCs, and even up to the corporal ranks, you know, they're 19, 18, 19, maybe 21, 22, and they do dumb stuff, and sadly sometimes people get hurt or they just do dumb things when they're overseas that they know they're not supposed to do. But yeah, they're just kind of getting their feet underneath them, and both as adults and as soldiers or Marines. That's not the case here at all.
Right, yeah, that's kind of a different...
That is very isolated and away from the main group here. They're not over there in a big, huge, like, division size or battalion size element where they're checking in with people every day. They're definitely independent operators on the mission.
Right, so you're talking maybe, you know, even with their support, maybe two dozen individuals in this area.
Right, it's definitely that kind of, you know, out there, beyond the wire type stuff. I mean, they are working with the embassy. They're in the city. They're not kind of, like, doing active combat missions, but they're definitely, they're in danger. I mean, they're definitely, like, they're expected to be able to handle themselves.
Well, and that kind of plays into another element of this story is, and I've talked to another friend of mine about this, that, you know, that the common element of this is the use of, or pretty wide ranging use of cash to pay off informants. And by its very nature, not a ton of accounting for that, because you're just trying to go to, you know, a village or a neighborhood and say, hey, do you know where, you know, the members of Boko Haram are, or, you know, or jihadists are. And so, you know, when you give this guy the money for that information, it's not like he's going to provide you with a social security number, you know, et cetera. And it seems like that played into a bit of possible motives here. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, and there's a long history. So just I'll try my best not to digress too much, but to give people some context, this is really akin, very much akin to, you watch like a show on Netflix like Narcos, or you watch a lot of like your kind of like drug related type, you know, Hollywood movies. They are kind of true to form to some degree in that, you know, a guy goes undercover in that situation in a law enforcement setting, which might be a lot more familiar to most of your listeners and readers. Like, they have a lot of free range, and they have to be in that area. This is even like that times 5 or 10 easily, because you're operating, I mean, full cash in Africa, trying to get people to do things or support people in security situations, buying them equipment, getting them weapons, paying cash for them to provide security or do something. And so, yeah, it's very much, there's accountability to a degree, but there's a whole lot of gray area in there that where people can, they really got to make the right ethical choice, you know, and that being said, also, you can go back and dig into, you know, some of the old Navy SEAL novels that I read as a kid and books like from Richard Marchenko, who kind of put SEAL Team 6 on the map as a founder, and they would use travel budgets, for crying out loud, to buy crazy stuff, and like, there's a bit of an outlaw mentality within some folks in there, not all, and they're very, very professional to a man, you know, throughout most of the ranks, but there's some folks, they get a lot of toys, they get a little bit of cash, and they can do what they want.
And I think that that's kind of played into possibly part of the motive here, in that at least it's been alleged that these two SEALs, or however many, were skimming from this cash surplus, and that they invited Staff Sergeant Melgar to be part of that. Is that correct?
It's not clear exactly Melgar's portion. Some of the reports vary a little bit. All of them, though, do confirm. Now, again, this, I don't have documents in my hand, sadly, but all of the reports from outlets I trust and from sources I've spoken with say that at least two of the SEALs that were involved in this had been or were being investigated for missing cash or misappropriation prior to Melgar's death. And then there's, of course, subsequent reports, you know, after the event, I guess, where he had been emailing his wife that there were things that he was concerned with that was going on there, but he didn't specify. And then there was some speculation, I think, and at least some leaks to investigators that he discovered this and was possibly going to reveal or rejected, you know, their offers to kind of cut him into it. And he was getting ready to rotate out, and he was almost done with his tour. He was at home pretty shortly after.
So in the night in question, or the early morning in question, like we've gone back through, you know, this would not be a time that you're doing mixed martial arts training. And
I mean, it's possible, but it's highly unlikely. I just to couch that in some good language here. I don't know. I scratch my head.
Yes. And I believe there's also an allegation that the parties were at a party or going to a party or some sort of gathering off base, and that the SEALs felt snubbed by the staff sergeant.
That was one of the reports that another witness had told, or one of the witnesses, and potentially one of the SEALs had told investigators. So first it was, we don't know how he died, we just tried to help him. Then it was, oh, we were wrestling and he fell on top of him, he didn't respond. Then it was, oh, we snuck into his room to get back at him because sometime the night or two before, we'd been walking to some party, he drove by and just didn't even offer to pick us up and snubbed us, and we were just going to teach him a lesson kind of thing. So yeah, the story evolves and changes with almost each investigative interview or each revelation. And so that was the last one, which of all the situations, like, again, it's possible, but my goodness, man, you guys are all, you know, in your 30s and professional operators. Somebody doesn't pick up for a party, that's like a kind of a teenage mentality. I don't know.
Right. And I'll tell you, listen, I've been choked unconscious doing, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and it's not like you go unconscious for a long time. I mean, you just kind of go out and then you wake back up. You know, it's not, it, if done correctly, and, you know, these guys have enough training on that, it's not something where it's, you know, I've been choked out a number of times in the same session. And, you know, you just kind of, okay, I'm good again. Let's go back to this. But it shouldn't be anything that's ever life-threatening.
Oh, I don't, yeah, just from personal experience, that's all I can attest to. I mean, I grew up wrestling and doing martial arts and stuff, not jiu-jitsu, but other things, judo and karate and that kind of stuff. And even before all that, I mean, I remember being junior high kid at, like, summer camps and as a kind of a weird trick. You'd, like, choke each other out, you'd come right back up, you know, in the next, you know, few seconds with, like, stars in your eyes and, like, you know, a headache. I mean, it was stupid. I would never allow myself.
Yeah, I was going to say,
I
like,
had a choice. I mean, I was a knucklehead myself. But, you know, no one was getting their windpipe crushed doing that, you know.
Right. And so we've had, and again, like we've discussed, everybody has the presumption of innocence, of course, but, you know, from my time as a prosecutor and defense attorney and your time from reporting courts, there is something suspicious about ever-changing stories, and that seems to be what we have here.
Yeah, that's always, especially when you think to, you know, if there is a charge. I mean, ultimately, you know, the ultimate end of this, if there is a charge, if these folks, you know, are not, you know, basically cleared of all this, you know, a jury has to hear this. And if you're sitting on a jury and you find out, wow, these guys, you know, time after time had a different story. Each of them had different stories to each other, and they changed their own stories within this. Like, what do you trust? And that's the one thing that you know, having been an attorney, that's the first thing you're going to attack. You know, I've seen it 1,000 times in court, and it's about credibility. So you can't trust someone's word when they're telling an official investigator different versions of an event every time you talk to them.
And so what's the latest? So we either have two or three Navy SEALs who have been taken out of, you know, their operational status and are probably doing some sort of administrative job. Is that what we think's going on right now?
Exactly. I actually, I was pretty tied up last week, but the week before, my most recent check with my sources, and as far as that time frame, anyone involved is back in Virginia. I think it's Samneck, Virginia. They're back there here in Norfolk. They're back there on administrative leave. Have been since probably sometime in June. Basically not operational, not going overseas. And I'm not sure if they're training or reporting or duty or in uniform or just, you know, sitting somewhere checking in once a day, but they're definitely going to go on an admin hold.
Or, as we would always say, passing out basketballs, that was kind of the default job you were given. We're like, okay, someone's got to do this, but really very little chance that you can screw it up.
Yeah, it's just a kind of like, you know, the exact same thing happens in police departments. I mean, you have a questionable shooting or something where someone's being investigated. Even if they're 100% clear, you know, I've even seen, when I worked in New Jersey in a newspaper there was a high-ranking police assistant chief, I believe, or police chief, I can't remember exactly. He had some charges about some kind of sexual misconduct situation. He was on an administrative hold for 2 years because there were union issues involved and appeals. And he was finally basically never charged and given all his back pay and retired. So let's just throw a bone the other direction. You know, these guys may have been on hold for a long time. It doesn't mean they're guilty of anything. It doesn't mean they're going to be charged. It just means that's the procedure they're going to take as they investigate this and figure out what they're going to do officially.
Oh, yeah, and I could say from, you know, were I put in the position of, or kind of unenviable position of trying to prosecute these cases, if they ever came forward first, you wouldn't want to put them in pretrial confinement because that starts some of your speedy trial clocks. So it is, I mean, it's on the government side, when, you know, putting on that hat for a moment, that is in line with what I would want, you know, that you keep them out so we have plenty of time to investigate this. And then also, I mean, that is not somebody as a prosecutor that you envy having, you know, if you wanted to prosecute somebody, having the highly decorated Navy SEALs, I mean, that's going to be a difficult road to hoe, you know, because they just the presumption of, well, these guys wouldn't do something like this, or, you know, these guys have done so much for their country. So I can see where it would be advantageous for the government to take a long time to make sure they had a very, very strong case before they made any decision about this.
Yeah, and that's another thing just to throw into that mix is the bureaucracy angle of this. I mean, you have a situation, like when you talk about a police situation in the United States, you're talking about a department, perhaps the police officer's union, and of course, like the local district attorney, kind of those three entities really working together before things flow into like the arrest and court phase. You're talking about Special Operations Command, Africa Command, you know, the NCIS investigating after having taken it over from Army CID. I mean, it's just a football getting punted all over the place, but also all these folks are going to have some level of scrutiny to this as it moves forward. I mean, the ultimate decision will reside with command and fall in line with whatever you CMJ, you know, situation they're going to look at. But you have a lot of entities involved, and it all happens somewhat with a clandestine mission in a part of the world that nobody's really watching.
I think that's an excellent point that you bring up. So for the listeners that aren't quite familiar with this, the U.S. military has carved up the entire globe into these different sections, and those are called combatant commands or geographic combatant commands. So there is a general that is in charge, a four-star general who's in charge of everything that happens in Africa. But then outside of the geographic combatant commands, there's also functional combatant commands, for example, Special Operations Command. So then there would be another four-star general who would be in charge of all the special operators. So then you have the overlap of you have a special operator functioning in the geographic combatant command of another four-star general. So there is at least some, I mean, having been around this, there's at least some, you know, bumping up by the staffs to kind of decide, well, who's going to take charge of this? And then you also have the other layer of then there's the Navy who quote unquote owns the SEALs, but they're members of that organization. So you can at least have three different organizations kind of, you know, playing musical chairs for who's going to be in charge of all of this.
Yeah, it gets complicated. You think it's complicated just on my side of things, just who do you call? You know, I mean, at this
right.
point, I'm checking in officially and on the record with NCIS, who has the investigation. And just as they investigated the service, they're not going to reveal any details. They're just going to say whether or not they flew it and who they forwarded it to. At this point, it looks like it'll either come out of either SOCOM or AFRICOM. That's actually not even really been decided yet, officially, as far as I know. So the next revelation on this, outside of reporting, any kind of official statement, documentation, or action, will come from one of those commands. And really, it's a question mark as to when. You know, I mean, I have no indication of when they're even going to conclude with that, or if they have concluded and it's being reviewed. A lot of this stuff happens way deep behind the scenes that, you know, we're just not really privy to. It's not even necessarily something you can access through records requests or anything until it gets to a certain point, at least.
Right, because the UCMJ allows that flexibility that, you know, the commanding officer may, you know, bring charges. So, exactly, you could have either AFRICOM or SOCOM be the commanding officer. That's kind of flexible. So we're sitting here right now in February of 18. The last reporting I've seen on this is late October, maybe the 1st of November of last year. Anything further that you've got?
No, I hate to admit it, but that's the freshest material I have. I have made calls, periodically to check in, but once you reach a certain point and they're in an investigative mode, it's really hard to go much beyond that. Of course, the New York Times had four people working on their last story on this, so I'm sure they're trucking away at it. They may have something to put out tomorrow, for all I know. But as for why I said, I'm probably not going to see anything myself until one of the commands makes some kind of official determination, and then if there's possible records requests to be made after that, if these things can be divulged or released.
Yeah, well, so how many stories have you written on this?
I think four, starting in when we followed up quickly after the New York Times. But mostly just kind of incremental push forward. And again, I'll give a lot of credit to my colleagues / competitors. I mean, they've broken off things that I've had to follow. But I'm doing as best I can. Kind of a one-man show over here. So.
Well, I'll make sure that we put all of those stories in the show notes. And where's the best place for the listeners to follow you?
I put all my stories and stuff and any related cool stuff that other people are doing at on Twitter. So it's T South Journo. It's like journalist. T-S-O-U-T-H Journo, J-O-U-R-N-O, T South Journo at Twitter.
Well, I'll definitely put that in the show notes. And really appreciate you being on today. And please, if it's not too much to ask, if there's more information on this, I will be sure to post all of your stuff on Twitter, but maybe if you could give us an update someday, we'd greatly appreciate it.
Oh yeah, still tracking. kind of waiting on the government, as you know, or even the other media outlets. But yeah, if there's anything on it, that'll be the first thing that it'll have you do that day, is this forecast for it, for sure. So it's a bit of a high priority.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Military Justice wouldn't be possible without the fine sound editing by Hannah McCarthy. And this episode is dedicated to the memory of my Uber producer, Dreadnought. You will always be missed out here.